I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Vic. Along with K2 KEY Kilo Echo Yankee, his name is Mel, and his daughter Julie, we act as moderators to something called the Technical Men. The Technical Men tries to bring together amateur radio operators from the tri-state area who help each other find greater enjoyment and greater understanding of how all this wireless equipment works. We sometimes get into how to make an antenna work better, what does an antenna tuner really do, why does the transmission line behave like that, what is propagation like on various frequency ranges, what are the various kinds of ham radio. There's 26 different kinds of ham radio. Some of them are more computer-oriented, some of them are more microwave-oriented. Inside of each ham radio operator is, in general, a curious person who would like to be a scientist. In many cases, that's true. They want to know how things work, why they work that way. Some of those questions get answered on the TechNet because this particular repeater has got reasonably good coverage for southern New York State, most of Long Island, western Connecticut, northern New Jersey. And there's a lot of smart people in that metropolitan area. They come along and hear a question and get excited and chime in and give us the benefit of their wisdom. There is no 100% guarantee you're always going to get a correct answer here, but I think our batting average is reasonably high. The majority of the TechNet is oriented toward a live, give-and-take, verbal conversation of a helpful nature among ham radio operators. There is no promise that if you write to Mel or Dick that you're going to get an answer. You're taking a risk. You might not get an answer. We did not promise that. A small number of worthy people, we do answer. But quite often you'll find people who are angry that they didn't get an answer to their written question. We're not promising to provide a written consulting service free of charge. And so each person who writes one of those letters thinks he's the only one. And Mel gets a large number of letters per week, and he can't handle them all. Don't blame him for that. We didn't promise that. So you accept that risk. A person signs into this Technical Net because he has a question or a comment. You need that sign in if you're just listening. After 27 years of the Technical Net, this is TechNet number 1274. By now, we sort of assume that there are people out there who are somewhat interested. Some of them get angry at us and go away for a while. Some of them eventually come back because they realize that there's more good than bad, so to speak. That's an opinion. But you sign into the Technical Net by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. Do we have any check-ins? Give me your call letters and name at this time. Wait for the beep. K2RIW. K2LDK,
Sam.
All
right.
Go.
Yes.
K2LDK, Sam, yes.
Okay, we got both Sam and Joe. You'll notice that there's a extra length of time before the beep. That's recently been modified. Thank goodness Eric was able to do that. And as such, with that extra length of time, if we all are not too quick on the key, we will not be timing out the IRLP link to the Eastern net, to the Eastern input to this repeater, as well as people who want to sign in by way of the Internet. We'll give them that opportunity. So we got Joe and Sam. Who else would like to sign in? Wait for the beep. Give me your call letters and name.
W2CYK, yes.
Mr. CYK, you didn't wait for the beep, but what is your name, sir?
Hey, Dick, it's Bob. W2CYK, sorry.
Hey, Bob, after the conversation we've had, if I wasn't so darn forgetful, I should remember your name. Okay. Bob, as you probably know, is the father of what we believe is not only one of the youngest amateurs who recently got his license, but he is the fourth generation ham radio operator in his family. And there's probably only a couple of those in the whole darn United States. Alrighty. Who else would like to check in with a question or a comment? Give me your call letters and name at this time.
WB2TGY. Name is Bob, and I have a question.
Okay, we got Bob on the list. So far, we've got Sam, Joe, Bob, and Bob. Anyone else?
W2SYL, Bill,
yes, no.
Okay, Bill with a no. W02N, give me your name, sir.
Okay, I said, yeah, my name is Bernie Dick. I'm checking in from the Eastern Link, so it's a little hard to catch. I think the repeater gets captured on the west end there, but I'm on the Eastern Link. Name is Bernie, W02N, and I'm a yes.
We certainly got you, Bernie. Not to worry. We're going to get to you. All righty, we got more than enough to get started. Sam was the first one to check in. K2, Lima, Delta, Kilo. Go right ahead, Sam. K2RYW, my name is Dick.
Yes, good evening, Dick. You were very helpful the last time I checked in with a Class C amplifier question. I have another amplifier question. I just built a 6 meter transistor transmitter for CW. Got 10 milliwatts of output, and I would like to raise that from about 10 milliwatts to, well, at least a watt. It doesn't have to be a linear amplifier, but from the Class C, I guess, could be equally as effective since it will only be used for CW. But I've been unable to find any circuits, transistorized circuits, that I can use. Tubes are easier, but for me anyway, but transistors, I have not been able to find anything. I can't design very much, but I can build everything, so I need to be pointed in the right direction. Just as a minimum, I'd like to know what kind of transistor I would need to take 10 milliwatts of input at 50 ohms and move it to about a watt. K12DK.
Very fine, Sam. I don't have a direct recommendation for you. First of all, you've got 10 milliwatts now. Most people in the RF world live in the world of decibels, and they usually relate everything to 1 milliwatt of power. 10 milliwatts is 10 times that. Therefore, it is plus 10 dBm. dBm, Delta Bravo Mike, means dB with reference to a milliwatt. So you're asking for an input power of plus 10 dBm. You'd like an output power of 1 watt. You go through the mathematics, you find 1 watt is plus 30 dBm. So you want plus 30 dBm output. You got plus 10 dBm input. The difference between the two is 20 dB. You're looking for 20 decibels of gain. Very, very few transistors produce 20 dB of gain. 10 decibels of gain is more typical. Oh, there's some LD MOS transistors which produce as much as 17 dB of gain. So the bottom line is you're going to use more than one stage. That's one reason you can't find a device that'll do it. Motorola, among other companies, have a number of devices that do favor the 50 megacycle region. Not very many of them anymore. I know most of the devices they're building these days are for the high volume market, like 800 megacycle cellular phone and 900 megacycle paging and 1800 megacycle cellular phone and so on. Lots and lots of reasonably high power transistors are being built for that frequency region. Unfortunately, the call for the 50 megacycle region, 6 meters, which is probably going to be a transistor that favors the, let's say, 30 to 130 megacycles. And transistors for that region at your power level are going to be a bit rare. That doesn't mean that you should give up. It just means that the know ahead of time is going to be a little bit hard. You're looking for more than one stage. There's got to be a module that somebody builds. In fact, one way to start off this problem would be to choose a rig that you know puts out 1 watt or 10 watts of power in the 6 meter ham band. Get a hold of the schematic diagram and find out what the final stage is. The final stage probably is a module that runs on 12 volts, that has 1 watt or 10 watts of output, and probably requires only 1 milliwatt or something like that of input. It's a module of some kind with built-in heatsink, and so you know you're going to be using more than one transistor. Some of these modules that are used in manufactured transceivers, some of those final stage modules, let me drop. Bell recognized. Some of those modules are very handy in that they've got a 50 ohm input impedance, a 50 ohm output impedance. They run on 12 volts or 28 volts. 12 volts is much more popular. Some of them will have a an extra line where you can turn the thing off, so to speak, so that it doesn't draw current. They can be linear amplifiers. It'd be nice to have a linear amplifier where you're running Morse code now, but the day may come when you'd love to run 6-meter single sideband. And for the amplifier to be thoroughly linear, many of those modules, most of those modules are thoroughly linear when used correctly. So that's a possible way to go. Now, a guy who's been down this road a few times, because he's been around a while, is Mel, and he's going to tell you how to do it. At least I hope so. K2KEY. Go right ahead, Mel. K2RIW. Wait for the beep.
Yes, been there, done it. K2KEY. Good evening, all. All right. I have recently did some work on a rig, and I replaced a transistor, and basically it was for 6 meters to total pass. The transistor that I used will give you 10 watts, very little drive really needed. You can do it with basically anything. They're very good at, in fact, it's basically just one stage, simple to put together. And the transistor is the MRF-492. Now, the ARRL has a book called RF Amplifiers. And most of the schematics are derived from QFT and QEX. And in it, they have that amplifier used in that transistor, so happens. I think they are maybe the first time saw the transistor. But it's a very nice, simple circuit. It's a one transistor, and like I say, it will give you at least 10 watts output. MRF-492 is the number of the transistor pick. Over.
Yeah, let me ask you a couple of words in that one, Mel. You think it's a one-stage device. 10 watts of output is plus 40 dB with reference to a millibot, plus 40 dBm. And if it only requires, let's say, 1 or 10 milliwatts of drive, that's we're talking about 20 or 30 decibels of gain here. So is it really a module? Is the MRF-492 a composite module? It's one nice package, but is it possible there's more than one device inside? Because it sounds like we're getting an awful lot of gain out of that. If it's a MOS or a FET device, I guess it is possible to get that amount of gain. Back to you for some comments on that, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Well, it's just a simple device, Dick. I don't know, really. Let's see. Let me remember the details of the device. The MRF series. Let's see. They had a number of series of them. The MRF-140, I remember. And let me remember about how much difference there was. The 492 and the 140. The 140, I remember, was an FDT device. The 492 was a regular type of bipolar type transistor. Let's see, who the heck was putting that out and they got it ready? I guess it was a Motorola device. But they used it in a number of their pieces of equipment, like commercial pieces of equipment, take over.
Yeah, the nice thing about the data in the Internet is you simply type into Google MRF-492. It comes up with the word data sheet. And I'm about to look at that data sheet right now, and it's going to tell us what it is. If I can particularly get the PDF of that data sheet, and some of these, it's looking good. Now, my machine is calling up that data sheet right now. We're about to find out what it is. Oh, they fibbed to me. It's a company that's advertising that with a whole bunch of other things, and That gets me kind of angry at times when these guys will say, yes, we've got MRF-492 data sheet. You go to that website, into advertising a whole bunch of other things. Anyhow, we'll get to that data sheet real soon, as I see it, Sam, and that's a good way to go. Let me ask you this, Mel. Assume now that we've discovered that the MRM-492 is a strong candidate to fulfill Sam's requirement. Do you have a rough guess as to where he would buy it and how many dollars it's going to cost him? You may or may not know, but what's your rough guess on that one, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW, and I didn't wait for the beat. You should.
I always do. I got the transistor. I got it from, I believe it was DigiKey. Moser Electronics also, I believe, has it. It's a standard stock device, Dick. It's been used considerably in a number of different amplifiers. There has been a number of amplifiers that they have, put out using the MRF-140 BMOS type series FET. Because, you know, you can get, you can take this little amplifier, stick it into that. There was another mention of another, in other words, to add to the 492, to add the, such as a MRF-140, and which will give you from 10 to whatever you're putting driving, you know. In other words, you're most likely going to be able to see something like a one of these brick type 160-watt output amplifiers that they're selling. Similar to that, you'll wind up homebrewing, which is not a huge job to do. And so you'll be able to look at something like, 15 dBs of gain, which is considerable. So just got to look around for that. I don't have the computer in front of me, so I have to take that you see it on the computer and give them some information. But it's the MRF-492, and you can build also, I could say, another stage onto it using the MRF-140 deck over.
Okay, Mel, I managed to get the data sheet on screen, and I'm amazed. MRF-492, Motorola product, I think it is, it's rated 50 megacycles, RF power transistor, NPN silicon, 70 watts. Output power, 70 watts. Minimum gain, 11 dB. So it's a beautiful transistor. As a final stage for a high power transmitter, fantastic. But I think it's a little bit beyond the power output that Sam is looking for. It's also a little bit lower in gain than he's looking for. He's going to need other driver stages. So we've given him a hint. This whole MRF series has some awful, beautiful devices. And this one's a good hint for what he's going to be using downrange. In other words, later on he's going to want to add an afterburner, we'll say. And this is going to be a beautiful device that gets him up to the 50-watt level. But before he gets there, he still needs some intermediate stages of gain. He needs more decibels at a lower power level, as I see it. I wonder if you were aware that that is a 70-watt transistor. Maybe we've slipped a digit on the model number of MRF-492, K2KEY, K2RIW. You? And then you recognize, but Mel first. Go ahead.
Well, the MRF-492, if I remember correctly, was used with small, type of handy talkies, around 5 watts. You put in around 5 watts and you'll get out. And, ooh, I think if I remember correctly, got to recall, but like I say, you've got 70 watts out of it, Dick. It takes very little drive, like only a few watts to drive into it. So if you, put in just any amount of drive into, well, you might get saved. You may have to add a stage. You would have to add a simple stage of preamplification, maybe, to drive the 492 correctly. But it's not a major problem to put in one more stage in a simple amplifier like that, Dick, over.
Okay, there's a couple of ways you can go here, Sam. Just because the transistor is rated for 70 watts power output capability, assuming the thing is not $1 zillion, assuming you can get one cheap enough, there's nothing stopping you from running it at a much lower bias level. In other words, let's assume the transistor is good for an ampere, and you can decide to bias it so it's only drawing 50 milliamps, so to speak. You could use it at a much lower power level, and most devices, when you do that, they become extremely safe. In other words, you take a 70-watt device, you run it at the 1-watt power level, for instance, it would allow you to put a dead short circuit across its output all day long, and the thing will laugh at you. It's got, you know, 70 watts of power dissipation, and you're dissipating 2 watts because you got it going into a short circuit, and it'll laugh at you. No problem. Safe as all hell. So you don't have to use devices right at the maximum power output. That's something worth considering. And when you do that, sometimes you get more gain. That's the good news. You also get a impedance mismatch. When you take a device that's capable of 70 watts of output and you bias it much lighter, the recommended schematic diagram for the input network and the output network will change. In other words, that transistor presents maybe a 70-ohm load on the input and maybe a 10-ohm load on the output when it's running at full power. When you run it at a lower power, the input impedance and the output impedance changes. So it's going to take some circuit modification. Now, maybe Alex has been there, and maybe Alex has got a suggestion. Let's find out. N2NNU, K2RIW. Go right ahead, Alex.
Yeah, good evening, one and all. I saw you enthused about the 194, was it? 494. Well, pull up on your screen, Dick, the 154, MRF 154, and tell me what you think about this guy.
Okay, it's going to take me a little while to get that. Let me pass it over to Sam and see if he understood what we've heard so far. We haven't given you the whole answer yet, Sam, but we're starting to give you some leads, as you can see. And the MRF 154 is one of Alex's favorite. I'm about to pull that up on my screen. Take your time and do a little bit of talking while I call for that particular component, Sam. And if there's anyone else who's got other transistors at the 1-watt level or a little bit more, at 50 megacycles, give us your call letters. And if not, Sam's going to pick up. K2LDK. K2LDK with a little delay. K2RIW in the SECnet.
Hi, K2RIW, K2LDK. No, I'm fully up on this, and I've actually picked up these data sheets. I'm now looking at the 154. The 192 looks really nice. This one's much too big. The 154 is 700 watts of, or 600 watts, 50 volts up to 80 megs. It might be good for some, but I'm using very low drive here. The power curve on the 492 looks like it will, you know, I mean, 10 dB again. If I can get the transistors going, I'd probably run a stage ahead of it. The nice thing is that Motorola published a little test circuit, little amplifier circuit for the 492 on their sheet, which really looks very simple. It's got all the values in it, and it probably could be put together rather quickly. So I might have to add a stage in front of it, but I think everything, you really put me in the right direction here. You're correct. I don't have an answer, but I think with a little bit more work, we can come up with something that will at least bring it up to, 100 milliwatts, and think we can try it again. But I think we can probably add a small stage ahead of it. With 10 dB of gain, then drive it to 100 to with another 10, and we'll get where we need to be. The reason for this transmitter is not to run it on 6 meters as a thing. It's going to be a beacon transmitter. It will be the beacon here for Long Island if I can get it up and running in good order. I have the Freakin beacon, which will be the CW input that has a EEPROM on it. So everything's ready to go, except I just thought that 10 milliwatts was a little bit too low to run a beacon here on Long Island. K2RIW, K12DK.
U.S.
I'm waiting to see if we're... trying to sign in, give us your call letters right now.
KB1NNH.
Give him some more information about using it as a beacon.
Okay, Mel's got some beacon information. KB1 sounds like November Hotel. If we got your call letters right, tell me your name and do you have information on this particular subject? Go right ahead, November Hotel. Sounded like the person said NNH. I may have heard it incorrectly. Want to try again?
WB2HW, 2SC 1307.
And the 2SC 1307, Howie, roughly how many watts, how many dB of gain?
It's about a 5 to 6 watt transistor. It uses CB rigs, about 8 to 10 dB to gain. It's an NPN device. They use it in a lot of the 11 meter rigs. We'll top out at about 50 megahertz.
What's your guess as to how many dollars and where should he buy it?
You might look, you can probably buy it from DigiKey. I don't have the specs on it. Probably going to cost you no more than about 70 cents. That device has been around since the 80s. It's used in all your little CB rigs. And the driver transistor is a 2SC1306. 2SC1306, 2SC1307. Two of those transistors, it's a pre-driver and a driver. One takes you from a few milliwatts, the next one takes you up to the 5-watt level.
Okay, I'm waiting for the beep. That sounds like a good combination. So write that down as another possibility there, Sam. 2SC1306 as the driver, 2SC1307 as the final transistor. Another candidate as I see it. K2KEY, go right ahead, Mel.
Sorry, I just don't like those two transistors. No, they've been around forever, and some of the early handy talkies and some of that equipment, I remember, some of the CD stuff, and remember having those transistors in it. I believe it in a TO2 case, if I'm not mistaken. I can almost picture them in a little tin case. I didn't particularly like those transistors. The 492 I like. It's a very versatile transistor, as you say. Now, if you're going to use it in a beacon or CW or even an FM operation, I suggest that you configure the amplifier for a Class C operation. Now, because if you go into Class C operation, you'll get efficiency somewhere around 72%, 75% versus Class B, which you most likely will only get around about 60%. So, to configure an amplifier for Class C use, you just have to make a little bit of very simple changes in it. Basically, you will have to just modify the base of the transistor, and basically I think you just can put it to ground and not have to put in any biasing diodes in it, Dick. So I suggest going to Class C, especially if you're going to use it on a beacon, which will be CW, over.
HWW, for a question from Mel, Dick.
Go ahead, Howie.
Yeah, Mel, I'd like to know why you don't like it's not the best transistors in the world, but they're dirt cheap. And for a low power application, they're pretty rugged. Can I ask you why you don't like them? Did I copy, Dick?
You sure you came through, Mel. Want to give us a couple of words on why you're not so happy with the 2SC 1306 and 1307 series? Maybe you had a bad experience. Want to tell us a couple of words about that, Mel? Go ahead.
From what I looked into them, pushing them up to about 50 megahertz is really, I think, on the edge of their operation, Dick, if I'm not mistaken. Maybe I'm picturing the wrong one, but I'm 99% sure that they basically, like Howie said, were used in a lot of the 11-meter rigs of that series. And if I'm not mistaken, there were some people that tried to push them up onto the 50 megahertz have found that they're really at the end of their curve. So, they may work, but I don't think they may not perform the way you like them. This 492 is a more modern device and a very flexible device, to say the least, Dick. Over.
50 cents is pretty cheap.
Okay, so how are you going to say, for 50 cents, go ahead and gamble, even if you lose a couple of them, whereas the 492, it's going to cost you a few bucks, is my guess. But there are devices out there. It's going to take some searching. The complete module that's 50 ohms in and 50 ohms out that's used for the final stage of respected transceivers, that's the Cadillac approach. More expensive, but a lot more trouble-free. It's just a little black box. You apply the voltage to it, and out comes a lot of signal, a lot of gain. These individual transistors of the MRF or SC series, they're going to do the job. It's going to take some experimenting. Mel's suggestion to go to Class C biasing, that really means that, let me backtrack. You probably know, Sam, but I'm going to be saying this for the benefit of other people who are listening. Class A is where you put a lot of bias current into the device such that it draws the exact same amount of collector current continuously, whether you're putting in a signal or not. Class B, you're using less forward bias, and it's starting to become nonlinear unless you're using it in a push-pull pair. Class C biasing is where, with no signal, the transistor draws no current at all. Only under drive does it draw current. And the advantage of that is that it runs higher in efficiency, runs cooler, and may give you more reliability. There's also something called Class Delta and Class Echo and Class Foxtrot, where you start using the device making square waves, and it runs at higher efficiency. I recommend you don't go there for the time being without a spectrum analyzer and quite a bit more smart and more exotic transistors. That could be a more troublesome mode. People go there because they sometimes desire the 90% efficiency capability. In your case, you're looking for simplicity and reliability, and whether it runs exactly 60% or 90% efficiency of the final stage is going to make very little difference to you in your particular application. Those are some of my opinions, Sam. Sounds like you've got a nice project there, and come back in future weeks and let us know how your research is going in selecting a transistor. And if you were on the 6-meter ham band already, you could start talking to the guys that are there. Some of them have homebrewed their equipment, and you can ask them what they've used. And to have a first-person testimonial from a guy saying, I used an MRF so-and-so, and I love it, and it did this and it did that, that's very valuable information. Back to you, Sam, for any final, and then we'll go on to the next person after that. K2LDK, K2RIW.
And I knew with the question.
Alex recognized, but Sam first. Go ahead, Sam.
Okay, K2RIW, K2LDK. I see them down here as cheaply as $29, $28. I could probably do a little bit better than that. But I will look around. I did see a module, but I don't remember what the configuration was. But you put me onto the right track here, and one of the things that I will do is I'll get the RF amplifier book from the ARRL. Getting close to Christmas, so I think I could probably score one of those. And I'll look into it and see if I can't find something that will raise the power to an acceptable level. But hope to be working on this project for some time, and this is about the third transmitter I've built for it, and this one seems stable enough to actually do the job. One of the nice things about beacons is that you keep them on the same frequency all the time.
Aww.
We'll keep everybody. I'll keep everybody up to date. Yes, I've been on 6 meters now, probably going on 54 years. But there's nobody to talk to up there, Dick. K2RIW, K2LDK.
You put up a high enough antenna at Bethpage, a big enough Yagi, radiate enough power. Guarantee you'll find people to talk to. They may not be right on Long Island. They may be in Maryland, Delaware, New Jersey, Massachusetts and so on, at least in the days when I was on 6 meters, it did have some very nice single sideband DX and Morse code DX too, although I'm going to guess that the Morse code operators down at 50.05 or so, it's going to be not as many of them today as there were back in the days when 6 meters was a kind of a frontier band. Alex has further question. Go ahead with your question, Alex. N2NNU, right to the beep, K2RIW.
Yeah, as long as we're talking about a 6 meter band, I'm searching for somebody to test my little QRP station on 6 meter band, and nobody comes back to me. I don't know, it's deserted completely. But that's not the issue. The issue is that I'm detecting a very, very strong signal data stream on 50.10, which is the international calling frequency, and I'm trying to hunt them down, but I'm not successful. I wonder if anybody in the group heard that signal on 50.1. So that was my question. I'll take it back to you.
On a quick break, do you have a 50.1 megacycle antenna that can be aimed? Is it possible you know the direction of arrival to your home in Yonkers? Back to you, Alex.
At this time, not, but I'm working on it. My antenna this time, it's a 160-meter band vertical loop, and that is not steerable. But I have a 6-meter antenna. I'm working to put it up. But I'm not sure that that will be a solution. I think it's too strictly local. I think I need something much smaller than a 6-meter Yagi, something sort of a magnetic loop on the 60-meter on the 6-meter band, something very small, or a ferrite, even a ferrite stab. We'll see if that will help back to you.
Yeah, direction finding that signal could be a lot of fun. I'll give a quick listen. Is there anyone who is also on 6 meters who knows about this data stream that Alex is hearing on 50.10 megacycles? If you know about it, give us your call letters right now.
Is it the international calling frequency 50.110, not 50.1?
Don, good question. Now, what is the exact calling frequency? That's a secondary issue. But apparently there's no one else hearing that signal as I hear it. It could be something very local to Yonkers, and therefore, if you've got a portable transceiver that, on a whip antenna or in a loop, direction finding loop, can hear it while that receiver is in your hand or on your automobile, once you can hear it that way and then drive around until it gets stronger and figure out the direction of arrival, that could be a lot of fun to do fox hunting in that particular case. But other than that, I suspect the total amount of activity on 6 meters these days is a little bit less. People are spreading out with software-defined radios and digital modes of communication, higher frequencies, lower frequencies. We've got some darn many choices. The total number of ham bands is really fierce, a big number. You start off at essentially 160 meters, although there's some experiments at even lower frequencies, and every single octave of the band is a ham band, and the total number of megacycles given to ham radio operators, if you include everything up to, let's say, 10 gigahertz, is a lot of bandwidth. Many commercial organizations would give their IT to own that much bandwidth that we own, that we have almost exclusive use of, and we should keep using it all, otherwise we run into the problem of use it or lose it. Portions of the 1296 band we no longer have control of, and 2304 band we no longer have control of, because we weren't using it very much. And a number of commercial concerns came along and proved to the FCC they would make better use of that spectrum. Our next questioner was Joe, W2RYY. Let's see what's going on in his neighborhood. W2RYY, K2RIW.
Good evening, this is W8. I have a question on the power supply. This is going back to the same power supply I had an issue with a couple of months ago, which I had a problem with a choke. Well, it developed the problem with one of the other chokes, apparently. At least I thought it did. But I made some measurements because I happen to be able to get my hands on a simple instrument to be able to read inductance, capacitance, and resistor values. The main thing that's interesting was inductance, and I got quite varying readings on the apparently bad choke and good chokes in this power supply. But the question is, on the initial problem I had, I have readings that are very similar to on this particular choke that I thought was bad. Well, actually, it's bad. It doesn't work right in the power supply. But I get very similar readings on a good choke, and I'm just kind of curious where that leads me to as far as what happens if this choke is going bad. Back to you.
Okay. You told me you've got a good one, you've got a bad one, and there's something going on in the bad one that you don't understand. You've given us no specifics, therefore we don't have any information to operate on. If I had an extremely good memory from 6 months ago when you first brought this to our attention, I guess I could make some guesses now, but that was 150 problems ago, if you know what I mean, Joe. So you got to give us a couple of specifics. What did you measure under what conditions that seemed strange to you? Back to you, Joe.
Okay. Well, if I give you too much information, it might be hard to digest all at once. So I'll give you the information as you requested. Let's see. This is not concerning the current problem with the power supply, but it's more or less going back to the old problem I had. On the bad choke, that was reducing the voltage output from, say, 420 volts DC across the higher voltage section of the power supply, which is above ground, by the way. It was reducing that to about 280 with this bad choke in there. That would get between the minus side of that supply and the higher voltage end of that supply. And with a good choke, of course, I guess the voltage goes up to about 410 volts. So it had that much drop with this bad choke in there. Let's see. Bad choke is rated, it has a specification of 3 Henrys at, no, excuse me, 5 Henrys. It's rated 5 Henrys at 75 volts maximum resistance. On two bad chokes, I measured 73 ohms. On a suspected bad one, 72.8 on the other one. And the inductance reads very similar between both. The inductance reading, I was able to read at, the instrumentation reads at 1 kilohertz and 120 hertz. You want those readings also? You want those periods of what those two were between the two chokes?
Yeah, I think we're going to need the apparent number of Henrys at either one of those frequencies, 1 kc or 120 hertz. I think I'd prefer the 120 hertz. But what was the apparent number of Henrys under the current drain of the number of milliamps that power supply is pulling? I suspect that the choke is changing radically for some crazy reason when current is being pulled through it. Back to you, Joe.
I don't have the information of how many Henrys the choke is what the rating is when I'm pulling current through it. I did not measure that. I can only give you what the instrument was capable of measuring, just according to the instrument itself. The bad choke at 120 hertz measured, give me a reading of 5.819 Henrys. Nominal rate will be 5 Henrys, okay. And it said it had a Q of 12.6. The good choke, a little higher, 6.858 Henrys, and a Q at 7.43, also at 120 hertz. So it was a little bit higher on the good choke. But I got similar readings on another choke in the same part of the supply, which is giving the problems, which my question is on, actually, that gave me similar differences between as far as the range of Henry's readings, because they were like maybe not quite the reading, but within about one Henry of one pair of bad ones, and they all seem to do the same thing in that particular power supply, which is drop the voltage again on the output of the lower voltage section, dropping it about 30 or 40 volts with that that's no load, and it's about 50 to 60 volts with load.
Yeah, a choke that goes, a bad one that's 5.8 Henrys and a good one that's 6.58 Henrys, very little difference. And also the Qs are mysterious. A Q of 7.4 on a good one and a Q of 12.6 on a bad one. Q is usually inductive reactance divided by resistance. It would suggest that your bad choke has less series resistance and almost the same number of Henrys. It's too bad that your instrumentation is not able to put the choke under real load. Something funny is going on under load. And now, in order for a choke to drop a lot of voltage, going down in Henrys, believe it or not, wouldn't do it. If it's a choke input voltage regulator or voltage filter network, as you make the number of Henrys go smaller and smaller, you'll get more and more volts out with more and more ripple, of course. That's the disadvantage. So by some magic, the only way I can think of that your choke could be dropping so many volts is that it either under load has a lot of Henrys, or under load it has a lot of series ohms. That's the only way it can drop voltage. Too many Henrys, or too many ohms of series resistance. Like there's an intermittent contact in there that only shows up under a working load when things heat up. That's a guess. You've still got quite a mystery there, Joe. And someday, when I do get back to your house and visit you again, I wasn't smart enough the last time I was there to say, show me that power supply with your oscilloscope and with your voltmeter and your load circuit, so that I could see it with my own eyes, with your own triplet or Simpson meter or whatever across that floating high voltage power supply. Because you certainly have a mystery there, and looks like it ain't resolved yet. Your Q meter or your inductance resistance meter is not giving us enough information that can explain it so far. WE2RYY, T2RYW in the TechNet.
Okay, well that same supply which I changed the choke in on the high voltage section, and it resolved the problem in that part of the section. Later on, a few months later, it developed the problem with the low voltage section. And I should have a nominal voltage with no load. Just the only load in the circuit is probably right now, if I don't have the transmitter connected to the power supply, is probably the current draw from the bleeder resistors, which are fairly high in ohmic value, like about 200K or something like that, in that particular section. So it's not really drawing a lot of current draw. But with choke in circuit, I'll get about 30 volt, 35 volt drop across the choke. Now, this is the funny part, which is a little, which I cannot explain. The last time when I replaced the choke, it solved the problem. This time, I took the choke out of a good supply, which had some other damage to it, and I put that choke in place of the inspected bad one, and I get the same voltage reading out. Now, I'm not dropping the voltage out of the secondary of this transformer to any appreciable amount at all. It drops about maybe 10, maybe 15 volts, actually at the load. But it's got essentially very close to being, you know, within reason, with no load, it has the right voltage going on to the input of the bridge rectifier circuit. And essentially this circuit's fairly simple. It has capacitive input, it has a choke in series, and a capacitor on the output of this filter network. And that's pretty much it. And when the choke is in the circuit, it drops, like even a good choke or a bad choke, I'll get a 30 volt drop across that choke. It's not supposed to be that much at all.
Yeah, you certainly do have a mystery there. You and I know that the combinations of the readings you're giving me, the voltage dropped across the choke, probably measured with a averaging meter of some kind, a digital voltmeter or a triplet, just doesn't sound right. So, when I finally do get back to your house, you're going to have to show me that one, Joe, so I can see it with my own eyes. Hopefully you've got a schematic diagram of the power supply, you've got the real power supply, and on your bench there we can set up your meters, and I'd like to see it, because strange. Out of curiosity, do you also own an oscilloscope, or when I come over, should I bring an oscilloscope also?
have a scope. I haven't plugged it in. I haven't plugged it in the wall in about 15 years or so because I've been using the carefully using one of my service monitors, but that's the whole trip. The whole unit is giving me a problem. It doesn't operate right now, so. I would say, yeah, I still do have a scope, a working scope. I get sprayed up about maybe either 5 or 10 megs as far as, you know, absolute top end, so it'll easily suffice for something like this as far as looking at something as simple as a power supply. So you don't need to bring in any test group like that over it. So this is definitely one of these mysteries. But on the bad choke I got, just give me the readings on 120 hertz of the... This is on the lower voltage section. The choke is nominally rated at 3 Henry's and has a nominal DC resistance maximum of 30 ohms, I believe is the rating of this thing. I got 24.2, 24.2, and 24.5. The second two were good chokes, and the first one was a bad one. I got a reading of the first bad choke, apparently bad, 3.820 Henry's. 9.61 at 120 hertz. The second choke gave me a much higher inductive reading, 4.380. That had a Q of 6.62. And third choke, again a good one apparently, had a reading of 3.062 Henry's and a Q of 7.09, all at 120 hertz.
Is there any way that you could measure leakage of a choke winding to ground? And unfortunately, it probably only develops this leakage when it's under load and giving off some heat. But if there was a stray resistive path between the choke winding and the grounded case of the choke, you have a way that you could sense that, that you know of, Joe. Go ahead.
Sometimes I tested this power supply 3 times, taking the bad choke out and putting the other two chokes in. The choke was laying on the table and was not physically connected to the chassis. So the choke was floating on the table. And I had a pair of foot leads go between the choke wires and the wires in the power supply. So the choke was not touching ground at all in any case. And in all three cases, I still had lower voltage on the output of the power supply. When I simply touched the choke lead, you know, the leads together, I would watch the voltage go up about 30 to 35 volts to get my normal voltage output. The choke's not in the circuit anymore either.
Okay, sure sounds like you've done the right thing by having the choke floating. All right, so that confirmation went down the tube. You've got a mystery there, Joe. And when I do come back and visit you, because I know there's a second reason why you and I are going to get together, just for the hell of it, I'll bring along a Tektronix 4-channel 2465 scope that I own, which is good too. I think 250 megacycles per channel. But I think about the 4-channel scope, is that you can use it in the A minus B function, you know, two of the channels in the A minus B function. And therefore, even at high voltage, you can measure differential voltage on the oscilloscope, let's say across a choke, and still have the choke, still have the spectrum analyzer, here we go, oscilloscope chassis grounded. Well, I've run these situations where you use a piece of instrumentation on a isolation transformer and the whole chassis is up at a high voltage. I've done that on a couple of occasions. Very dangerous. And with a A minus B function, we won't have to do that. So, looks like we don't have a solution. You still got a mystery. You've got a tough one there, Joe. Alrighty, the next guy on the list was Bob, W2CYK. Hope we haven't put you to sleep, Bob, out there in out east on Long Island. I think you come through the eastern input of the machine. W2CYK, AQRIW.
I was going to give him a suggestion, Dick.
I'll go ahead with your suggestion, Mel.
Okay, anyhow, what I would do, he says he's got one good power supply that's working, I think I understood, with the choke in it. I'd like to measure the current, with meter, the current reading across the choke from no load to load, Dick, over.
Yep, that's a good way to go. And I think Joe has already done some of those measurements. And he's getting mysteriously high voltages across the choke. That's a hard one to accept. I mean, when you're getting 30 or 40 or 50 volts dropped across the choke, that's only got 30 ohms of resistance. It implies that the choke is seeing an ampere of current flow. And if he's only got the bleeder resistors there, it doesn't follow. By the way, the mysterious signal you hear periodically is coming through the eastern input. And if need be, we'll have to disconnect the eastern input. But for the time being, let me go over to Bob. W2CYK, go right ahead, Bob. K2RIW.
Yeah, hi, Dick. It's hello to the net. It's kind of really dumb, but I've got a PSA-30S that was showing no power out. But the other day, a young Jesse said to me, hey, Dad, can we fix the radio? And I said, you know what? Yeah, let's fix this thing and see if we can figure out what's going on with it. So I tossed it over dummy load and got no output. And I don't have a tube tester anymore, so I changed the finals. I had a set of finals on the shelf. That didn't do anything, so there's one tube left. Is that the 12BY7A? Is that the preamp to the finals? Is that what's driving the finals, Dick? Go ahead.
Okay, I'm a TSC-830S, I think you said.
Repeater.
You're assuming I'm familiar with that particular rig, and maybe I'm not. So I'm not going to be able to answer that question for you. Maybe Mel is familiar with that particular rig. Let's see if Mel does. K2KEY, K2RIW.
I can help with that, WHCDL.
Okay, stand by, Mel. Go ahead, Andy.
Ready for the beep. Yeah, just for clarification, that 12BY7 is the driver tube to the finals. A lot of times there's a cathode resistor that's where the meter is being measured across. Meter is being measured across the cathode. Sometimes those resistors open up. You have to check that. And you may have lost high voltage or screen voltage. In the back of the radio, there's a switch which turns the screen voltage on. If you don't have any screen voltage, you won't have any plate current, and you'll have no power output. Make sure your screen is turned on.
Ah, very good. I will check that. There was high voltage. That's one of the first things we checked, was there high voltage. That looked good. And, where is this resistor? Are you familiar with the physical location? I gotta dig up the schematic. But what would it be attached to?
Yeah, the reason why they have the screen switch, you could neutralize it with the screen voltage or, which I don't do anyway. These resistors are on the circuit board underneath the radio. Take the bottom cover off, and they're on the circuit board that holds the tube sockets. Resistors are there. The meter is measured across that, across the cathode for the plate current. All right, back to you.
All right. He says the cat, just to be clear, then I'll hand it back to Ned. You said it's the resistor attached to the cathode?
Do you have a schematic for the radio?
I can download one. I can find it. But is that the resistor you're talking about, the cathode?
Yep, waiting for the beep. Yep. I think it's the low ohmic value. I don't remember the exact value of the resistor. It's been a while since I've seen the inside of that radio. But look at the schematic. Look at the schematic. You'll see it. And again, look at the back of the radio. Make sure that switch is on. There's a switch on the back panel.